What's up, guys? Welcome to Script Blast, a podcast to help you write better screenplays and write a better life. You're probably wondering who I am and why you're not listening to Hudson right now, so let me introduce myself. My name is Avery. I'm a writer from Charlotte, North Carolina, and the new producer of this podcast. Today, Hudson is interviewing Michelle Leibel, a writer from Atlanta, Georgia. Michelle has worked in the industry as a PA on shows like Telenovela, Bachelor Live, and Good Girls before making a name for herself as a staff writer on the ABC show A Million Little Things. This episode was recorded during the COVID-19 pandemic and just before our hiatus in late 2020. Now me, I'm fresh out of college, so I tend to find myself feeling pretty insecure about my experience and what I can bring to the table. So if you're anything like me, stay tuned because you're going to love Michelle's stories of how persistence and honesty got her from filming childhood sketches for All That to sharing her voice in the writers' rooms of an award-winning show. Now Michelle constantly stresses the importance of being able to bounce ideas off others as we create, and she's right. One of the biggest assets a writer can have around them is a strong and supportive community. I feel so much more productive when working with others, but the right community can be pretty hard to find these days. But I have good news. If you're tired of all the ads, robotic algorithms, and jerks that troll online community pages, you're not alone, and you don't have to deal with it anymore. We've just launched Script Blast Members, a brand new private community for writers just like you. We've got weekly writers group Zoom calls, free courses and resources, and the coolest community of writers on the planet. Since I'm new to writing, I felt kind of nervous putting myself out there, but ever since joining, I've felt nothing but love and support from the members group. I've met people from all walks of life and from dozens of time zones. Yet we can all come together to ask questions, get feedback, and share our fears about writing and anything else that's on our mind. Some of my favorite things to do are participating in polls and sharing interviews from my favorite writers. You too have a story to tell. Try it free for a week at members.scriptblast.com. Now here's Hudson and Michelle.
Michelle, how's it going?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How is life in LA right now in the middle of all this pandemic, stay-at-home kind of craziness right now?
It is complicated, I guess. It's like the entire world feels like it's shut down, even though I know that it's not. And
right.
It's been, for me personally, like very difficult to sort of be productive in all the ways that I sort of was planning to be productive during this time.
there is a disconnect between what we want to do and what we're capable to do when craziness is going on, right? I mean, just kind of like emotionally and mentally how we want to be productive. And then it's just like, I spent the first week of this thing literally 24 hours a day Googling just data, like just trying to figure it out, you know?
Yeah, I sat on my couch for a full hour today and thought about all the things I wanted to be doing in my home, like things I could be doing that I just was like, I can't move.
Yeah. What about professionally? Are you working during this time or where are you at in kind of the season of the show and everything?
So we fortunately finished production of our season before really the quarantine started. I know that there was the last sound mix right at the beginning of like everyone stay home.
Yeah.
And then we aired our finale of our second season during Safer at Home. So
gotcha.
We have not had to do any work. I'm currently not working. I'm just, but there also hasn't been any like show pickups or not a lot of them right now. If I had to guess, it's because they don't know when production will be able to like safely start again for anything. So I think we're just sort of waiting to see what happens. But I do know that like some rooms that are still going are doing it like over Zoom.
Wow.
Which just based on my own like family Zooms, I imagine is very difficult.
Right. And we'll get into the details of your career in a second here. But what does that mean? Like when you get to the end of the season, do you not know if you're going to have a job come the next season?
That is correct. Usually it's called, you know, hiatus when a show goes off the air and you don't know whether or not it's coming back, or even if it is definitively coming back, it's still called that. Last season, we got a pickup for season two while we were still finishing filming season one. So,
and that's what you want.
Of course. Yeah. So it was like much easier to go into a couple months feeling like, well, I guess I can just like, you know, have some time before we start back in again. But yeah, it's definitely, you know, it's freelance. It's, you just sort of hope that your show comes back. And if it doesn't, you hope you can get on something else.
Yeah. Yeah. So we first met, so this is a cool story, because we met really randomly in a coffee shop, like in a North Atlanta suburb. How long ago do you remember?
Yeah, we met at a Caribou Coffee in the summer of, I believe it was 2012.
Oh my gosh. And I don't want to think of how long ago that was.
I had a really big crush on the barista that worked at that coffee shop. And I was not 21 yet. So I like wasn't hanging out at bars. So I just like hung out at that coffee shop like every day, flirting with this barista who was like, I don't know, 17 years older than me or something.
That's never, so funny. We had a
it crossed my mind that I was like, oh, why is he like still working in the coffee shop for like?
Yeah, we had a crazy store, another crazy store in that coffee shop where we were casting for our very first short film. And the name at the top of our list was Tony Hale. We ended up going with a local actor, but like, you know, we were dreaming at the time and we were like, wouldn't it be great if we had Tony Hale to star in this? He'd be perfect for it. And the barista at the place came up to us and said, oh, I heard you say Tony Hale. He was actually in here earlier. Like, what are the chances like he would be in that Caribou the same day that we're there?
And by the way, I think that might be the day we met, because I remember him saying Tony Hale was in here, and I'm a big Tony Hale fan. too. And I remember being like, I'm in here literally every day, all the time. Like, why?
And you missed it.
Did I miss this?
That's really funny. I bet that was the same day. So that goes way back before my career even really started. I had done some stuff by then. We had kind of had our taste of fame with this Lionsgate deal, and then everything fell apart. And then we were trying to reinvent ourselves as filmmakers and actually making stuff in Atlanta. And I remember talking to you about potentially coming on that summer when we were hoping to shoot a feature. And I think it took us another 5 years to get that feature going.
Yeah. And you know what, now that I think about it, I think it was actually 2011, because the summer, the summer of 2012, I was working as a locations PA for The Walking Dead. And I know that would have happened after, because I think before I was really just looking to like be a part of any production I could.
Any possible thing.
Yeah. And, and at the time, obviously not now, but at the time I remember looking for an internship, and my mom was a production coordinator for many years in LA and then moved back to Atlanta where she was from to do commercials for Coca-Cola. And so she was friends with the former president of the Georgia Film Commission or something. And I think she gave him his first job, and then she reached out to see if I could get an internship there, and he didn't work there anymore. And beyond that, they were like, we are not busy enough to need an intern, which I'm sure is not the case now. But at the time, they were like two things filming in Georgia, and they didn't really have any space.
Yeah, it has definitely changed a lot. So going back, though, of you kind of growing up and in high school and everything, what was your dream at that point? Like, was TV always the goal? Like, you wanted to be a TV writer? Was it something in comedy? Did you want to be a performer? What was your dream at that point?
I would say in high school, I probably wanted to be a performer. I did a lot of musical theater. I think every play, including like non-musicals, you know, some people just call those plays, but not me. and I think I just was really, I knew I liked entertaining people, and I always was very interested in my lit classes. I liked writing, but I never really thought about like, I don't even think I really understood that TV writing was a job when I was in high school.
Yeah.
You know, I never thought about it. I think I went into college undeclared journalism.
That's so funny. That was my goal in high school too, was, oh, I love writing. I love movies. I should study journalism. Because that was the only job that you could think of where you could write for a living. Like the idea of TV or movie or film writing just didn't connect for some reason.
Well, I think that a big part of it for me too was because I didn't know those were jobs. I didn't really want to be I think when I was applying for colleges, I was like, I don't really want to do musical theater anymore. Like, it kind of takes up so much of my time, and I get sick every year at the same time. And I just want to know what my life would be like without that. And I got very obsessed with the idea of writing for Rolling Stone. And like being
was
like,
it after watching Almost Famous?
It was not after watching Almost Famous, although I have obviously seen Almost Famous, and
yeah,
it did not seem as appealing to me anymore. But I remember reaching out to like some internship coordinator there, and they like never answered me. But I was like, that's going to be me. I'm going to be writing for magazines, because I spent a lot of time reading like, you know, 17 and other, you know. I think a big one for me was Entertainment Weekly. Like, I just really liked reading magazines specifically about like entertainment, whether that be music, yeah, or movies or whatever. So I was like, that's the thing. And it wasn't.
So what was it about? And, you know, you're young, you love entertaining. What was it about entertaining exactly that connected with you, you think? Like, was it the like creation of stories? Was it bringing things to lives? Was it just like making people laugh? What was it that really drove that?
I'm sure a lot of it was making people laugh. I mean, when I was really young, when I was like 8, I used to make my own episodes of All That, which was like a Nickelodeon, and I would make my mom film them, and I would make my friends be in them with me. And I stole all the best parts for myself. And tragically, while I was planning to send my episode into Nickelodeon, my mom or my neighbor's mom, I can't remember who had the tape, taped over it for a Disney movie.
Oh, no.
And instantly my dreams of being a child star were completely obliterated.
Oh, this would have been slightly pre-YouTube, right? So you didn't have that outlet as a possibility?
Yeah, we didn't have that. It was literally like a camcorder, you know, like VHS tape which makes makes me sound like I'm pretending to be older than I am, but that's really like what it was.
Yeah.
So I really wanted to do that. And then I think, not to get very like therapeutic about it, but like I'm a middle child. Like you spent a lot of time by myself. I think there was probably a huge part of me that wanted to like, you know, make myself known a little bit. And I was not a popular kid, and I wasn't a very attractive kid. And so I think a lot of the time I really focused on like, well, what else can I do? Like, I'm not super popular, and my haircut is terrible, and I have had braces for 5 years, and like, well, maybe I can make them laugh, you know? So
yeah,
I think there was a lot of that. I mean, luckily now you guys can't see me, so you'll just have to take my word for it that I am stunningly beautiful and extremely popular. So I don't even know what I was worried about, but yeah, I think there was always a part of me that just sort of wanted to impress people for whatever reason. Yeah.
But there's another part of this, just listening to you talk so far, that I've recognized that you have no fear in terms of putting yourself out there, right? So you had an idea to film something, you filmed it, you emailed Rolling Stone, you talked to that random guy at a coffee shop who was making a short film, right? So like, what is it, where did that come from, that part of you? Because I'm a super introvert, traditional kind of writer, what you think of when you hear a writer. And those are like all my worst fears, like put myself out there in that way. Was that always part of you, that you were willing to put yourself out there?
Oh, I think from the earliest, like one of my most traumatic memories, and this sounds so stupid, is when I was a kid, my best friend's mom called me a blabbermouth, which isn't a big deal. But like when you're, you know, really little and it's the meanest thing anyone's ever said to you, you're like, oh no, this makes me feel horrible. But I've always been very, very outgoing. I have had no fear of strangers. It's possible that some of that stemmed from my mom basically telling me that like no one would ever kidnap me because I would annoy so much by talking that they would just drop me off.
That's great.
So that might be some of it. I did some stand up in college, which was scary, but I realized that I was sort of doing it already at like parties and stuff. I would start telling stories and then like stories of things that happened, but then like eventually figuring out what parts of those stories really caught people's attention or made them laugh or made them, you know, lean in. And then I eventually honed those enough that like my, everyone has like rehearsed party stories, a story they've heard a thousand times, but I started doing that a lot. And also really working in a weird way, like to make it sound like it wasn't the third or fourth time I told that story, like really trying to make it like the first time. And that was important for stand-up. Started doing stand-up and then realized I just loved making people laugh. And I felt very, it's this weird dichotomy of feeling very self-conscious, but also feeling very powerful. Because when you have a microphone, you have hold of the room, hopefully. Not always the case, but hopefully. And it was really an interesting way to also learn how to pivot quickly when a story wasn't going well or a joke wasn't landing. And sort of that was one of my first realizations that I liked telling stories.
Right. Because with stand-up, it's kind of a math problem, right? You're like, oh, I did it this way and it didn't work, so I have to fix it. Like you're constantly problem solving, right?
Yeah, I would definitely say problem solving more than math because I am uniquely terrible at math in every way.
Yeah, I don't think that's unique to creative people. I think we're all terrible at math.
I think if you knew how bad I was at math, you would just...
Yeah, but there is something about like solving the problem, right? Of I need to work this until it works, right?
Yeah, definitely. And a lot of, you know, sort of figuring out too, like sometimes I think personally, I think an important thing, and maybe I do it too often, but I think that there is value in sometimes just throwing out an idea. Like sometimes you can unravel and rethread and then you're just like, it doesn't work. Like, why doesn't this work? My general rule is like, if something is so hard to figure out a story problem or something, like you're trying too hard. Like there's probably a simpler story solution, but also sometimes it's just not a good story, you know, like that happens. and I think not enough people sort of embrace when that happens, which there's something to be said for like the fortitude to like move on with a story that you really believe in. But if you stop believing in your story, it might not be a story worth telling. And it might be worth going back and figuring out what story is worth telling.
Do you think a lot of writers struggle with that, in that they tell a story and it doesn't work and therefore they think they're a bad storyteller when in truth it's just the wrong story?
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, every writing is such a personal thing, and some people are really good at writing stories that don't actually have a personal tie to them. I think something that I really commend in A Million Little Things that I've said to my boss before is that, like, just because the show deals with so many topics, it's a drama, but and with some comedy in it, but it really deals with, like, it runs the gamut of like alcoholism, depression, suicide, adultery, cancer. There's a lot happening. And while so many people can relate to one or some or all of those things, sometimes there are people that have never experienced any of those things, and yet they find a connection to the storytelling. And I think that's really the key to good storytelling, is making someone care when otherwise they probably wouldn't or have no reason to. Like, you can find something in there to relate to, because you're essentially telling a universal story about a specific thing.
Right. Yeah, that's great. So let's go back to your kind of your story. So take me from the moment that we met, 2012, 2011, to the point that you're like hired to write on a TV show, because that's amazing. What's your journey from that point? Because I know you've jumped around and you've done a lot of things. You've lived in a lot of places. Tell me a little bit about your journey.
Yeah, so it's kind of convoluted, and I've tried many times to distill it into a very palatable story, and I failed, so we'll try again. I went to Elon University in North Carolina for college, and while I was there, like I said, I went in undeclared journalism, but while I was there, I got introduced to a sketch comedy group on campus that was primarily men, or let's be honest, they were boys, primarily boys, who really liked writing sketches about like that fun conversation they had at Walmart last week. And like, you know, remember when we went over to Todd's house and had a party? And it's like, okay, these are not, these are not things I can relate to really, but I like being a part of it. And ultimately I met the head writer of the sketch comedy group who was a woman, and we became very close friends, and I started writing sketches. And the first time I heard one of my sketches out loud, because they used to do kind of table reads of the sketches before they decided which ones to do. And the first time I heard one of my sketches out loud, I enjoyed it so much, being able to listen to it and not be in it, and also just like hear people laugh at the jokes that I'd written. And that was so fun for me that I remember thinking like, oh, I want to do this. Like, is this a job?
Right. Yeah.
And I was also like obsessed with Saturday Night Live and had watched like every Saturday when I was a kid, and, you know, wrote letters to them that never got answered. And, and then eventually my sophomore year of college, which I think is the same year we met, but I wrote this 10-minute play with that other writer who I met. We wrote a 10-minute play for a 24-hour play festival. And it was the kind of thing where it was mostly for actors. Like, it was only advertised to acting students. I don't know how we found out about it, because we were like the only communicating people there. It was basically for actors to like write their own material and then get paired with someone who wanted to direct. And we, it was cool. You had to pick an image off of Flickr. They do like, I don't even, does Flickr exist anymore? If it does, they have like a random image generator, and you clicked that and whatever image you got, you picked three elements of that image to write a 10-minute play about. And you had all night to write it. It was a 24-hour festival. So you write, you know, all night, and then at like 6 a.m, they would start rehearsals for your show and with the director. And then
that's amazing.
Put it on that night. It was so cool. We were paired with a director who was really fun, and she had a lot of fun with it. But we also drew out of a hat the gender distribution of our cast, like how many people and how many were men, how many were women, which is like kind of antiquated because like who cares? But that's how it was. Sure. I think we ended up with 5-6 characters to play with, and it was 3 guys, 3 girls, and the photo we chose was this like sexy woman on a bed with a cross necklace, and we were like, okay, sleepover, we'll do a sleepover. So we wrote this horror comedy play, which was the only one of that genre that evening. all the other ones were like drama pieces.
Sure. Yeah.
And ours was funny and people loved it. And it was really, really fun to sit in the audience and like hear people's honest responses to your show, because they don't know you and they don't know you wrote it. And, you know, no one knew us anyway because we were not part of that program. And that was really like such a fun, creative thing to do. And it just made me really, I think after that, I was already a communications major, but I was like, okay, now it's time to focus on like what my concentration is going to be on. And I really think it should be like narrative film, which is the closest thing that they had at the time to a TV writing major, even though the year I left, the year after I left, they started a TV writing major.
Oh man. So what was it about TV specifically that drew you then? Like, why would you not be like, oh, I want to write movies?
To be honest, a small part of it was that I found the film community to be so douchey. just like even thinking about the fact that I have a degree in cinema is like very cringy.
Right. To me.
Like I fell asleep during Citizen Kane. It's not my favorite movie. I had a great time in school, but I also feel like I was surrounded by mostly men who were like, I'm going to be the next, you know, XYZ famous director, famous writer. And it just really was a turnoff. But I think also, just on a very basic level, I think it had to do with my attention span. I really like features, movies for me, I love them, but I will sit down. I recently sat down and watched every single episode of Cheers. That's 200.
Cheers is awesome.
It's 275 episodes. That's how I've spent my quarantine. But if you then said to me, like, hey, Michelle, you should really, you should watch The Godfather again, I'd be like, I don't have time. It's just a different mindset for me. TV has always been sort of my like comfort food. And so I think that appealed to me a lot more. And specifically at the time, I think I was thinking more of like SNL type stuff, which is so specific.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think I think in a lot of ways, TV writing and movie writing are so similar because in so many ways, a pilot is a short film.
Right.
So
was there something about, because you wrote that first play with a partner, was there something about the collaboration of it too, that you're like, oh, writer's rooms, there's multiple voices, you're really building off of each other. It's the kind of yes and of, you know, improv kind of stuff versus the kind of auteur theory of film where it's like one voice. Was that part of the appeal?
You know, I wish it was. I'm sure on some level it was, like, you know, I loved writing with someone and I thought it was fun, but I don't think I knew enough at the time how TV writing worked to be like, oh, gotcha. If I were a TV writer, like I could do this all the time. That said, it is so difficult to write on your own. Personally, for me, it's really hard to write on my own after being in a room for so long, because you get used to sort of the luxury of being able to leverage a room on an idea or a problem. And when you're by yourself, there are only so many times you can like call on a friend to be like, hey, is this dumb? So,
well, you kind of talked earlier about this idea of throwing stuff out there and figuring out if it works. And that process goes so much more quickly in a group than it does on your own, right?
Oh, for sure. And I think a big part of helping me with that personally was stand-up, because I would use stand-up to figure out what stories I really thought I could tell. And when I was writing like my first thing, my first pilot just for myself, I was like, oh, okay, I already know this story because I, you know, told it and people liked it, you know, so it's not, it's a little less trial and error. Of course, it's always trial and error, but my senior year of college, I made a short film because I don't know how to say this. I kind of conned my way through college. Like, I somehow got a reputation for being like a very good writer, which is not a brag. It's just like what happened. Although nobody, to my knowledge, had ever read anything I'd ever written. So I was very confused about how that even came to be. Like, it got to the point where I was asked by some peers to like help run a screenwriting workshop. And I was like, that's cool. But like, I've never written anything. You're like, oh, you, like, ha, ha, ha. And I...
Right, you're so humble.
Yeah, and I, like, catch me if you can, my way through screenwriting in college. Finally, my senior year, I was like, you know, I should really write something on my own. And so I wrote this short film about a couple who breaks up in front of a movie theater on Valentine's Day. And you find out that they were actually not a couple at all. They were just making a scene so that they could get a free ticket. and
funny.
It was like really short. It was 4 pages long. It was fun to write. And it was based on my friend and me. And I had that friend direct it. And another friend shot it. A professor oversaw it. I executive produced it. Like, we cast it. We shot it and edited it, and ultimately we submitted it to the film festival at school, which I was the vice president of, so it felt a little insular, but it won like best short film or whatever, and that was cool. Although, again, I was like on the board. I didn't vote or anything, but it felt...
Yeah, you were the sole judge of it, yeah.
I hosted the festival and then presented an award to myself, so that was a weird... And then I submitted the script to the Nashville Film Festival that has, at the time, I think it still does, it had a place for short films as well. And I ended up getting like second place in the short film category, which was really cool and like very validating to come from like a place where I was basically in charge of who won to a place where I had absolutely no say whatsoever. So wrote on those small coattails for a while and then moved to LA once I graduated. I didn't have a job when I moved out here. I was renting a room from a friend and I was looking for temp work, but I had applied to the NBC PAGE program, which is like a post-grad paid internship at NBC Universal. And I'd gotten through a couple rounds of the interview process, but hadn't heard anything, flew out for a final interview and didn't hear anything after that, decided to move anyway and did temp work, ended up on a temp desk for one of the producers of Pitch Perfect, not a creative producer, but like a financial producer. And that was like quite an experience because I was not experienced enough to be on his desk, but I was there anyway.
And did you kind of, in that scenario, is it like when you're thrown into this, do you learn quickly and then you actually do a good job? Or was it like, I have no idea what I'm doing and I still had no idea what I was doing?
Yeah, I mean, it was like, luckily there was another executive assistant next to me who'd been there for like years and she and I were friendly and she showed me the ropes very quickly.
Gotcha.
But it definitely was a hit the ground running thing for sure. And so many assistant jobs here are so specific to the person you're working for, not the job itself.
Yeah.
Because when you think about it, like it's really not that hard to like manage someone's calendar or answer the phone or send emails, but it is hard to manage personalities.
Sure.
So you kind of have to find the right fit.
Can you back up a second? Because you graduated college and you knew you wanted to write in TV. What was the goal at that point? Was it like, oh, I'm going to move to LA. I'm going to be an assistant. I'm going to work my way up. Like, did you have a very clear path or was it like, I'm just going to figure this out as I go?
Oh, gosh, I think I just decided I was going to figure it out as I went. And like, I think part of that plan was like, and every single person I meet, I'm going to tell them I want to write for TV.
Yeah.
Because it's important, I think, that people know what you do or want to do. I got advice, I don't even remember from who, but they were like, you shouldn't tell people you want to be a writer. You should tell people you are a writer. And I was like, okay, but I want to be a writer. They're like, yeah, but you are a writer. I'm like, I don't think so. So I know people that worked for that kind of like confidence never really, I don't know. It made me feel like I was lying every time. So I didn't really do it, but I did try to meet a bunch of people. I luckily have a pretty good alumni network out here from Elon. Like there were a lot of people out here that I knew already. Oh, and I'm sorry. I skipped a very important step, which was the summer after my junior year of college, I was a PA for The Walking Dead, season 2. And I got that by accident. I had applied to the commission and they didn't have jobs. And then I said this already, but when I applied, they were like, well, we don't have a job to give you, but The Walking Dead is always looking for PAs. And I was like, yeah, okay. Like my first job is going to be for like the biggest show on television. Sure. In my resume that has nothing on it. And they did. And they called me in for an interview. And I had, as soon as I got called in for the interview, I watched the entire show in like 2 days because I had never seen it. And when I got there, they were like, are you familiar with the show? And I was like, yeah, I've seen every episode. And they were like, okay. Which like hot tip, don't do that because no one wants to hire like a weird, crazy fan.
Right. Yeah.
And I almost wanted to be like, I didn't like it. But like, that wouldn't have been good either. But anyway, for some reason or another, they hired me to be a locations PA, which is basically like the person who gets there very before everyone else to set up like traffic cones and like pick up trash and, you know, do whatever it is that they have to do that day. I mean, locations is much more important than that. They lock down all the locations for the production. Literally without them, you wouldn't be able to shoot anywhere. But in terms of like the job that I was assigned, it was like, stand there and make sure no one pulls out of this driveway for 14 hours. And like,
right. And when you say before everybody gets there, what's that, like 4 a.m.?
It depends. For that show in particular, They did a lot of night shoots, and because filming days in the US are usually like 12 hours, they would start at like 2 p.m. to make sure that they could be done filming by 2 a.m.
Gotcha.
And I lived an hour and a half away. So I would, if my call was 4, I would be there like 3 hours. I'd like leave 3 hours before that because of traffic or whatever. And then get there. And then on the way back, I would be like looking at all the hotel advertisements, you know, for a bed on the way back as I was like falling asleep. And, but I knew that if I did that, I would be spending my whole paycheck just to.
Right. Yeah. Wow.
And it was such a fun experience. It was also the first time I realized how many people it takes to make a show.
Yeah.
I think a lot of film programs, or at least mine, which I consider to be good, but at the time, you know, it really made it seem like there were 4 jobs in production. It was, you were either a producer, you were a sound mixer, you were behind the camera, or you were directing.
Right.
There really was no talk about like, what is a line producer versus, you know, a creative producer? What is the writer's role on set? How many jobs are there in each department? What are the departments? Like, I don't, you know, no one thinks about props until you need one. So it really an eye-opening experience. They had such a big crew and they were all such a family, which is like one of my favorite parts of production anyway, is really feeling close to the crew that you're working with. And it was so fun. And they were really welcoming and I learned a lot. It was also excruciatingly hot and humid and Georgia in the summer. And it was not an internship. It was a job, but I still had to go back to school after. So I didn't stay for the whole season, but I stayed for a lot of it and came back to school. And after doing that and having that show on my resume, I found it so much easier to apply to internships and jobs because everyone was obsessed with the show, even though all I did for the show was pick up trash in the rain and tell people where to park. They were like, what was that like? I was like, oh, it was wet and a little dirty. So after that, my school told me I still needed an internship credit because technically my job had been a job and not an internship, and I needed an internship to graduate. So I applied to an internship in New York and an internship in LA, and I ended up getting the internship in LA, and that was for The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson when that was still on. Now it's Corden.
Yeah.
And so I went, I guess Walking Dead was summer after my sophomore year. Craig Ferguson was after my junior year. So I moved to LA for the summer, lived with a friend, interned there. The internship ended 2 weeks earlier than they said it was going to. And then I was trying to find a job to see if I could stay in LA for 2 weeks and I couldn't find anything. So I ended up having to come back home. But then at the end of the end of my senior year, I was like, okay, well, I have a bunch of family in New York, but my professional connections at that point, which were just that show, are in LA. So I think that was a big factor in deciding where to move after college.
Yeah.
So I moved out thinking, well, I have like a decent resume for someone just getting out of college. I could probably find something. Maybe I'll work a desk job for a couple of years until I, you know, I don't know, meet an agent at Starbucks and tell them my amazing idea. You know, like, yeah. So I don't know how much, I mean, it's been like 6 years now. I'm not sure if I really even thought so much about what I was going to do. I just kind of knew I wanted to do it. I got into the NBC Page program, I think, because I sort of told them I had no idea what I wanted to do, even though I thought I wanted to write for TV. I sort of realized after my Walking Dead experience that there are hundreds of jobs in entertainment and television that I had probably never heard of. And I felt like the Page program was a good way for me to learn what some of those were.
Yeah.
And at its core, the Page program is a corporate training program, and they want future executives and future heads of entertainment. And I realized pretty quickly that that wasn't really the world I wanted to be in. I wasn't really, first of all, I have no business casual clothes. I like have never have. I hate all of them. But I also just felt like it was a little too structured for me. I wanted to excel, but I felt very constricted. The program did open a ton of doors for me. I did a rotation in press and publicity. I did a rotation in standards and practices, in alternative programming, which is like game shows and unscripted television. And all of it was so interesting. I had the most fun in alternative programming, which was a surprise to me because that's unscripted, but it was really, really fun. And I learned so much in standards and practices because that was the place where they get every script and every cut before it goes to air, because they have to make sure everything is, you know, PC or up to their standards. So weirdly, the place where I heard the most interesting conversations, you know, how much side boob is too much, you know, like it was around the time e-cig started getting to be bigger. So it was a conversation about like, well, does that count as smoking on TV? And if so, like, who do we allow to do that? And all of that was really helpful to me. And it just happened that by chance, I was following this Twitter account that posted job listings that were not otherwise posted, because there is an industry job list that goes out. I'm not on the listserv anymore, so I don't know how often it goes out. And I, with coronavirus, I don't know when, if it is at all, but
yeah,
through an agency, it goes out. And I used to get my hands on that all the time and apply, but you know, hundreds of people see that list and it's very difficult to sort of get a job from there. And this Twitter account posted jobs that weren't posted on that list. And I saw, while I was working at Standards and Practices, I saw a listing for writer's assistant in a comedy room. And I instantly texted my friend and I was like, what do you think? I'm not qualified for this. And she was like, okay, so what? So they don't hire you. I was like, right, that's fair. It's actually the one move that I feel like I did that I would not recommend to other people, even though it worked out for me, which sounds counterintuitive. But I know, as someone who has tried to collect resumes to fill a position before, there is nothing more frustrating than clearly stating like what you're looking for and having someone apply and their first line is, hey, I know I'm not qualified, but, and it's like, okay, well, I can't unless I know you personally, I can't really vouch that you'd be great even though you're not qualified.
Yeah.
In my case, I got lucky because what happened was the person that emailed me back said, you know, we actually filled this position, but we're looking for a writer's PA, which is an entry-level job in a writer's room that I was qualified for. And they asked if I wanted to come interview with them. And they happened to be an NBC show, which I didn't know until they emailed me back. And they were on the lot. And so was I. So I took a golf cart and went, you know, 20 feet and interviewed.
Yeah.
And then they hired me. That was for the show Telenovela, which was a one-season show on NBC that was a comedy with Eva Longoria. And they hired me as a writer's PA, so I left the Page program a little early. They usually, now I think you have to stay for a year. At the time, I was 8 months in, and they were a little more lenient on when you could leave.
Gotcha.
So did that job. That was like really also an eye-opening thing. Was my first time in a writer's room, which was like so cool. Even though I wasn't in the room, I was, you know, basically the office manager for the writers, getting copies and printing scripts and making sure they had everything and getting lunch. And they were a really lovely room. And I still talk to some of those writers. They have moved on to, you know, other things, but they, sometimes would let me sit in the room if I was done with everything that I had to do that day, which was huge because a lot of rooms that I know of don't do that.
Mm.
And even like, I think once they asked me to come up with like a list of names for a character or a magazine or something like that. And that was like really big for me.
Yeah.
I named a male stripper and I like called my parents and I was like, you'll never believe what I did. And they were like, oh. Good for you.
I finally made it.
Yeah. Guess what? And then after that show ended, I was unemployed again and looking for jobs. Luckily, because of the Page program, I was able to say to them, I was a Page. I know this lot. I know the people here. I could cover a desk, which was something sometimes pages did anyway. And NBC has their own internal temp agency. So they set me up with like an executive temp gig. And every time for months, like every time someone was sick, I would fill in on that desk, which was a different way to get into a bunch of different departments. I was in like media, digital marketing was one for a while. I weirdly worked my way up like the corporate temp ladder and ended up temping for like really high up executives instead of like coordinators, which is what I would have been a lot more comfortable with. I thought every day I'm going to mess something actually important up and I'm going to get fired from
cost the company millions of dollars. Yeah.
There was actually one scary time when I was temping for like one of the chairmen of NBC and I printed out this spreadsheet for him. And again, terrible with numbers, don't understand them at all. And I didn't realize that I'd cut off like three columns.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And like to the right, which I know enough to know means like those are the summary column. So in the middle of this meeting he was having with like, I don't know, like I think it was literally the head of NBC. I had to like, I realized, freaked out, printed it again, ran in, swapped them. And I was like, here are the new numbers, which like not a thing.
Right.
And put them down and then left. And I was like, oh God, I'm so fired. Like I'm so fired. And I had no other job. And I also was, again, because I don't own business casual clothing and I was taking a risk, I was literally wearing like ripped jeans and sandals, like an executive office to be like, here are these new numbers, girl who walked in from a farm or something. So that was terrifying, but he like did not care. He was so nice about it.
Yeah.
And then I ended up temping for one of the producers of Telenovela. And he and I kind of had an arrangement that I would stay with him until he found a suitable replacement to be his assistant, or until I found a job I actually wanted to go to instead of just bouncing around all these different PA jobs. And eventually I got a writer's PA job on Vinyl season 2, which was an HBO show that never aired. And we got canceled, I think 6 weeks in. There was like a shakeup at HBO and they just didn't want the show to go forward. We hadn't even turned in any writing, so it wasn't that. And that was really disappointing because I'd finally gotten in another room and then we were canceled. But the showrunner of that show was like so nice. He made sure all the assistants got paid out for the next couple of weeks while we looked for something else. And I couldn't find anything. So I ended up going back to that development desk for that producer, and he was really good about me sort of still applying to other jobs and looking around. And while I was there, I met a girl who was working for a writer, and she was like, well, we're about to do a pilot, I can put your resume in for an office PA if you want. And I sort of was like, all right. My temp boss at the time had just found a replacement for me, so I didn't have anywhere else to go and I needed a job. So I took a job working for the line producer and director, and I ended up getting really close with the director. And so when the show got picked up to series for season 1, he asked if I would come to Atlanta and work on the show as his assistant for season 1.
Oh, wow.
And he was the producing director for season 1, so I moved back home, lived with my parents. Luckily, I mean, it happened to work out that I had a place to stay and had to be hired as a local, and that was fine. And I worked for most of the first season. I know I'm telling this a little bit out of order, but the first time I worked on the producer's desk, the guy who worked on Telenovela, I met an assistant who was working in that building as well, who worked for a writer. And I never met his boss, but I became friendly with him. And when I left for my job at Vinyl, I got an email from his boss saying, like, congratulations, I've heard such good things. Hopefully we'll get to meet sometime. But in the meantime, like, congratulations. And that was DJ Nash, who's my current boss.
Oh, wow.
And I was so floored. I was like, how does this person who doesn't even know me, like, why are they writing to me? That's so nice. I wanted to do everything I could possibly do to like keep in touch with him, but we didn't end up meeting. We didn't end up meeting until after the pilot was shot, because while I was waiting to hear if it was going to go to series, and I was once again unemployed and temping at NBC, he reached out and said he was looking for an assistant that was possibly going to go. And so I met him and interviewed with him, and then his show didn't go, but did. And that's when I moved to Atlanta. So that was that little time chunk there.
And during all this period, were you, because you're actively working, but are you writing on the side? Are you still like, is that still the goal, is like, oh, I want to be in the writer's room, I want to be writing on a TV show. Was that still what's driving you? Or were you kind of like, you know what, I'll just take whatever comes to me at this point?
Oh, I definitely wanted to be in a writer's room. And I really felt okay. the more I was working outside of a room, the harder I felt like it was going to be to get back into a room.
Gotcha.
There's no scientific evidence of that. It's just kind of how I felt. And so I was doing everything all the time to see if I could get back in a room. I was working on like a pilot. It wasn't something that I was like immensely proud of. And I wasn't writing every day, and I wasn't, you know, like my process was terrible. I was exhausted all the time and working all the time. And really the goal was just to keep working so that I could stay.
Yeah.
And so after I moved, when I first interviewed with DJ, I was so desperate for a job that I was like, I'll do anything. I'll babysit your kids. And like, you're not going to have to do that, but I appreciate it. And I was like, yeah. Okay. And then when his show didn't go, he called me and was like, I remember you saying you'd babysit my kids. So I ended up babysitting for his family for a little bit.
Oh, that's funny.
Until my boss asked me to move to Atlanta to work on the show. Which I obviously did, but I kept in touch with DJ, and he actually tried to get me another job while I was in Atlanta. Like someone he knew was looking for an assistant, and it just didn't pan out. Mm. And then right as season one was wrapping up, he called me and said he had a pilot that was going to be shot, and he needed an assistant for it, and interviewed me again, then hired me, and I moved back to LA, and I got such a terrible flu. I had a terrible flu, and it delayed me going back for a week. And oh, man. So when I got back to LA, I was in my apartment living out of a suitcase because I was so busy trying to catch up on all the work I'd missed when I was sick that I didn't even have time to like go back to my life. I'd been gone for 6 months or something, and I didn't wow. have time to like even like say hi to like my boyfriend. I was like, I'm busy, I'm working.
And
so I've been on a million little things ever since, really. I was the showrunner's assistant.
So that was that show then?
Yeah, that was that show. That pilot okay. was a million little things. Gotcha. Sorry, again, I told you I'm not good at telling the story.
Yeah. So your first job on that show was what exactly?
My first job on that show was the showrunner's assistant on the pilot.
Okay. Which is a big deal to be a showrunner's assistant, right? That's a pretty envious job.
I would say of the jobs that you want when you're trying to write, that is one of the big ones to try and land. It's like that gotcha. Or a writer's PA job. Any job that gets you in a writer's room is a job right. that if you're a writer, that's a job you want. And it was definitely yeah. a job I was after.
So I want to ask the question, because your resume gets you in a room, but there's something that is getting you the job. So I want to ask you about those interviews, and what is it that you feel would impress people enough to actually hire you? Like what is happening in those interviews?
I'm thinking back on these interviews, and I just have to say, like, I don't know that I did anything that great. I mean, cause to be honest, like I gave you the list of most of my jobs, but I hadn't many other jobs between those things.
Right.
It would take hours to tell you, but it was PA yeah. jobs and personal assistant jobs and nannying jobs and a couple of, you know, every so often, especially during times of unemployment, I would say, okay, well, you know what? You can suck it up and work at a desk job for 2 years and save money, and that'll be what you do. And it's fine.
Yeah.
You're still young and you have time. So I would go and apply for some, like, you know, desk job for a VP of development or something. And I'd get to the interview and I just couldn't do it. Like I remember interviewing with someone who was a VP at a like pretty prominent company, and as soon as I stepped in the room and started talking to him, he was like, you don't want this job. And I was like, no, I really don't. I'm so sorry.
That's funny.
And he gave me his card and was like, well, if I can ever help you out in the future, let me know. And I think some of it, I think a lot of it had to do with how, with honesty.
Yeah.
I think you always want people to know that you want the job if you do want the job. Otherwise they find you out pretty quick. But I think it was really about expectations. I think something that really helped me maintain a lot of my relationships was just not lying. I mean, it sounds crazy because of course your instinct is to not lie, hopefully, but even when I was working for the producer who I temped for so long, which I really wouldn't have stayed afloat if he hadn't, you know, kept me employed. But at the same time, at one point he offered me a job and I basically said, you know, I know I would learn a lot here because I already have, but you don't want me for this job. You want someone who wants to be a development executive and I don't want to do that. I want to be a writer.
Yeah.
So as soon as I get a writing opportunity, I will leave. And I don't want to put you in a position where you've put your time and resources into me and then I leave.
Yeah.
Which is a tough thing to say because you never know, like he easily could have been like, get out. And instead he said, okay, well then you can stay until I find someone or until you find something. And I felt like that was fair and really lucky.
Yeah. I had a conversation with a couple other filmmaker friends today and they've done a really good job at kind of branding themselves. And we had that conversation of basically like, I was talking to them and I said, you guys could have taken any number of jobs, but because you've branded yourself with what you really want to be doing, that's what people come to you for, right? So it's about really understanding what you want. And it's not necessarily turning down everything else. It's just having this clear kind of goal of what lights you up, of who you are, of where you're going to thrive. Because the truth is, if your job doesn't do all those things, then you're going to fail at it to some degree anyways. You might be passable, but you're not going to really thrive at it, right? And I think that's a hard thing for people because we all have an idea of what we want, but then, oh, this opportunity, this opportunity, this opportunity. I don't want to miss out. And it kind of, we start building these false sense of ourselves, like, oh, maybe this wouldn't be so bad, right? Mm-hmm. But the people that really thrive, I think, really understand what they want to be and they don't settle for less.
Well, I think that's all true. Additionally, I think a big part of it is I always thought that artists should struggle, but I don't think that you have to suffer. And I think that there were a lot of times when I was really, you know, starting out where I took every job because I just sort of was like, I have to, you know, this is how you meet people, this is what's going on. And there were some jobs that I hated and like I would cry in my car and I've never talked to those people again. You know, it's like
the experience
was beneficial in that I realized I never wanted to do that again. But I think that at a certain point if you can afford to say no, it's a really powerful tool because a lot of this industry unfortunately takes advantage of people that can't say no for whatever reason, usually financial, and you end up in a job that you don't want, doing stuff that you don't want to do for money that isn't very much, and you feel like you have to do it because if you say no, you might never work again or you might, you know, burn a bridge that isn't important. And I think networking is so important, but I think sometimes the amount of attention it gets as a tool can be detrimental to like what you think you should actually be doing.
Wow.
Because, you know, you don't have to say yes to every interview and you don't have to say yes to every job and you don't have to put up with something just because you don't want to burn a bridge. Like you're allowed to say, no, I don't feel comfortable putting together air conditioning units because I'm not qualified to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't feel comfortable printing out spreadsheets.
Yes. If you're like me, you're not comfortable doing any small task. But I think that's part of it. And I also think that like, you know, I got very lucky with the people I ended up working with because even in interviews, you know, I interviewed for some really nice people and I worked for some really lovely people. And I think that's not everybody's experience, unfortunately. And sure, there were times when I worked for some real, you know, people that I never want to see or work with ever again. I've been yelled at on conference calls and blamed for things that weren't my fault. But, you know, ultimately I ended up in a really supportive, collaborative space, like a lot of the time.
That's amazing.
I think it depends on attitude as well, because the one nice thing about feeling all the time like you're kind of a fraud is that you don't have an ego about it. No one's bragging that you like shouldn't be there. And no one wants to hire someone that they feel knows everything. I think the biggest reason I got, again, like the biggest reason I got into the PAGE program was because I said, I don't know what I want to do. But, you know, that's not the true for every single person. It's just sort of worked for me. And I think also people, especially people that are successful in entertainment, they like talking about themselves. But beyond that, they like feeling like they've helped someone. You know, if you say to someone, I'm brand new and I don't know what I'm doing and I'd love for you to teach me, that's such an ego boost for someone. Like, think about any time anyone's ever asked you to teach them to do something because they think you're better at it than you. Like, that's such a nice thing to hear. That, like, you're going to spend more time and effort and attention into helping that person because they flattered you, but also they probably mean it.
Yeah. That's a great perspective, too, because so often, like, I'm afraid to ask people for help because I don't want to, like, inconvenience them. But you forget that asking them for help is actually an ego boost to them.
It definitely depends on the type of help you're asking for, I would say. Like, you know,
yeah, that's a great point. Yeah.
Me getting an email from someone being like, can you read my screenplay? Like, that's not flattering to me.
Right. Yeah.
That is a burden. And then I have to figure out either how to say no or I read it and I'm like, oh, this person doesn't want notes. They just want me to tell them it's great. It's also hard in a different way. I think it's about like sort of really wanting to like learn and see things and not with the ulterior motive of thinking that you know already.
Right.
That's a huge thing. I think so many people I interned with had such an attitude of like, yeah, I mean, I've been here, done this or whatever. And I'm like, no, you haven't. Like, you've never been here. You've never done this. And every show, every production is different. I've now worked on like a late night format, a talk show format, unscripted TV, scripted TV. And I've been on, you know, sets for short films. Everything is different. Every production is different. Every crew is different. Hopefully every story is different. And it can be, you know, you can always find something that you didn't know. No one wants to be in a room with someone who knows everything.
Right, right. So tell me, okay, so we left off in your story and you are a showrunner's assistant on A Million Little Things. How do you go from there to being a full-time writer on the show?
You have a boss who believes in you more than you believe in you. I don't know what I did to sort of deserve to meet DJ, because I can't think of anything particularly good that I've done to deserve it. But he is like very rare, I think, as a showrunner. He is collaborative and kind. And this is not a ploy to get hired again, because I've already said all this to him, but also like I mean it. He's someone who believes that best idea wins. So it doesn't really matter what your title is. And because of that, he told me early on, like I was allowed to be in the writer's room, which is very rare for a showrunner's assistant because normally they're not, which is why writer's assistant jobs are usually much more coveted because they're in the room.
Okay. Yeah.
But he sort of was like, as long as all your work is done, you can be in the room whenever you want. You should be there whenever I'm there. And, you know, you have a laptop. It's not like I'm chained to a desk or something. So he let me sort of shadow him in a way. I mean, even though it was my job, I went with him to like every meeting. I was in the room with him. I was in editorial with him. I went to set with him. I learned so much from that. And before that, I think a really important part of that was the fact that I had job experience on set, which every time someone asks me, like, you know, I'm an aspiring writer. I want to be a writer. How do I get right into a writer's room? I've never had any jobs. And I'm like, okay.
That's a problem.
It would be great to first get a PA job somewhere. on some set, yeah, because it is wild to me how many writers don't have any set experience. And while that's totally fine, it usually means that you wrote like a killer screenplay and got representation before you had to do something like that. Most writers' rooms, or at least the ones that I've worked on, those writers go to set to make sure that the episodes are sort of turning into what we envisioned. Mm-hmm. And there is almost nothing worse, speaking as someone who had been on a set with like LA writers coming in all the time, than like the idea of like, ugh, like big Hollywood hotshot writers coming to set where they don't know anything. Like, this is our turf. It's such a weird dynamic that's so present. And I remember it from like working on set for a whole season of a show where I was like, you know, as the producing director's assistant, every time a new writer came, I was like, I was thrilled to meet them because I wanted to be a writer, but I heard the crew all the time being like, ugh, like, we don't want these LA know-it-alls coming here and telling us what we're doing. I mean, there's such a divide there. But if you have set experience and then you go to set as a writer and you're able to say, hey, like, this is the first AD and that should be my point of contact for getting anything that I need because they are in touch with all of the departments. You know, that makes things easier, or knowing that there's a difference between the people in the art department and what they do. And, you know, like just sort of having that prior knowledge of how a set works, I think is really helpful. And if you're trying to be a showrunner's assistant, it's almost essential because the showrunner has to also not just deal with the room, but also with production and editorial. And so if you can already come into it with a knowledge of what the different departments do and who the best person to contact would be, you're ahead of the game.
Yeah. So you luckily answered a lot of my questions just talking, which is fantastic in terms of just what does it take to break in and how do you do that and all that. I am curious, because I don't hear a lot of people talk about it, is what does it take mentally to break in? Like, we understand that, you know, okay, you get the jobs, you interview for the PA positions, you get some assistant jobs, you definitely move out to LA, you keep kind of writing on the side and doing all that stuff. But what does it take to prepare mentally and emotionally kind of for that journey? Like, I mean, you talked about taking jobs where you're like sitting in your car crying and like there's some difficulties and just this uphill battle. Do you think it takes a certain type of person to make it in this industry, or can everybody adjust to it in somehow? What advice would you give just on that side of things? Not the practical side of things, but just, you know, that emotional journey.
Yeah. Well, two things. One is that I realized I didn't actually tell you how I became a writer, but I will admit it.
Okay.
Two is that to answer that question, I think I'm not sure it takes a specific type of person. I think that there are certain qualities that, like, for example, when I'm looking to help someone hire an assistant that I look for, one time someone told me about, I was filling in, you know, I was temping for someone, and I asked the assistant next to me, like, why, like, what wasn't working with the person there already that I was filling in for? And she sort of thought for a minute, and she was like, she was like good at her job, but it was always a no before it was a yes, which really stuck with me. I think there's something to the attitude of like never saying like, no, I can't do that. Always saying, you know, let me see what I can do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because no one wants to be told no. And also no one wants to feel like you're not trying. I personally have always thought that if you ever wanted to do anything else, if you could see yourself doing anything else, do that thing. Like, yeah. In my opinion, no one moves out to LA because they really just really want to be here. It's expensive. It's tough. I mean, New York is the same. It's expensive. It's competitive. When things are going really well for you, it's amazing because you're surrounded by all of these very driven people who are also succeeding, or at least their Instagram says they are. Yeah. When you are, you know, not doing as well as you'd hoped, you are surrounded by people that you're constantly comparing yourself to. And that can be really, really tough. And it can feel, you know, in long stretches of unemployment, it feels a lot of the time like, will this ever happen? Like, it's so, you know, this is really hard. And I had a friend once tell me it takes 7 years to get to where you want to be in LA, which is, at the time I was like, oh, that makes sense. Like, you know, I've only been here for 2 years. I have so much time. And somehow for me, that was true, you know, within 7 years, because I'm on year 6, I got to where I, you know, want to currently be. But I realized like a little bit later that like that's such an arbitrary number, and it's a number people give themselves so that they can feel a little bit better, you know, because no one knows. The path to stuff is so different. You see that thing that circulates the web every like couple of weeks where it's like, you know, Tina Fey was like 35 when she, you know, J.K. Rowling wrote all of her stuff on a napkin when she was like 50 or whatever. And like, it's true. Like people, everyone's journey to this is so different. And like, just because I'm working now doesn't mean I'll be working in a year. I mean, I hope I will be. And, you know, with this virus, truly, who knows? But like, but I also recognize how much of an advantage I had when I moved out here, because, you know, my journey as a like, you know, white woman coming from a upper middle class family is different than someone who truly like doesn't have a support system or doesn't have that kind of money, or, you know, like there's a lot of factors coming in. I would say like I started working and saving to move to LA like 3 years before I moved.
Wow.
Because I knew it was going to be expensive and I didn't want to be in a situation where I couldn't afford it. But it is, you know, there were definitely times when it was close for me. And like, luckily I had parents who could help me if I needed it. And not everyone has that. So I think also there's like really no shame in trying to take a job that's maybe not even in the industry, just to sort of keep yourself afloat for a minute before you do or can.
Yeah. I think that's awesome. And I think that gives people a really good sense of what it actually takes, because I think there is a romanticism of it sometimes that, you know, is true at times, but it really is working hard and planning and having realistic expectations, which is hard.
Yeah. I think here's the thing, this is where the difference of people kind of does come into play, which is like, there are people who genuinely leave college or leave wherever and are like, I'm going to be the next Spielberg. And that's my, like, I'm Tarantino. The world just doesn't know it yet. And that's fun. It's great to have confidence in your ability. I wish I had more of it, to be honest. But I also think that a lot of the time I see those types of people sort of have these huge reality checks once they actually try and pursue that, because it's not as easy as they thought it was going to be, because even though they're the most talented person they know, like there are other talented people that exist, and that's part of the draw of the industry. You know, it's full of different creative people who are all good at different things.
Right.
And sometimes the same thing, and that can be really threatening. And also sometimes there's no reason you don't get a job that you thought you were going to get. And I started asking people after interviews, you know, if I didn't get the job, I started following up and being like, okay, well, why didn't I get it? I mean, like in a nicer way, obviously. It was more like, you know, hey, you know, I really enjoyed our interview and I was just wondering for the future if there's any, you know, advice you would give me for the next interview that I have, because I've been looking for a job for 4 months now and I haven't been able to find one. And I was wondering if you could, you know, give me some pointers. And sometimes people were like, oh, you know, it wasn't really anything specific, you know, just better luck next time. And one person actually had drinks with me and was like, to be honest, like it wasn't up to me, but like here are things that I have done in interviews that helped me, and I'm happy to look at your resume and, you know, things like that. Always people that are willing to sort of help if you ask for it. I mean, sometimes they're not, but sometimes they are. So it's worth trying if you're not getting where you want to be.
Yeah. All right. So to wrap up your story, you went from showrunner's assistant to writer's room. What was that process?
So in the first season, I was the showrunner's assistant. And then the way that my boss sort of writes is he like talks out ideas a lot, and he has his assistant type. And so I was typing while he was talking. And so I was formatting, which was really helpful for me also to sort of learn how a script should be formatted. And, you know, there were times when I would like pitch a joke, or he'd say like, what do you think of this? And eventually I became more comfortable, and he was very collaborative and let me sort of pitch ideas and dialogue sometimes. And then in the room, I was able to talk sometimes, not a lot, but like, you know, sometimes when it was appropriate. And halfway through, or I guess towards the end of the first season, we had to do there was a script that needed a rewrite, and instead of asking for the room to stay, he asked if I could stay, and we rewrote the whole script. And then the next day, the network called him and said that they really liked it, or they emailed and said that they really liked it. And he said, if you have 5 minutes, let's jump on the phone. And he basically was like, if you liked it, you need to let me hire my assistant, because she wrote it with me.
Cool.
Yeah, it was really, really cool. And he bumped me up to being a staff writer when we got additional episodes ordered that season. And I was still his assistant. And so I was doing both. And then once the season ended and we got picked up for the second season, he sort of was like, you know, I need to find a new assistant. But once I do, you can just be a writer on the show. You don't have to be my assistant anymore. So this season I was just a writer, not an assistant. And that was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're going to wrap this up because I know we're going long, but real quick, I would love to just know the process on that show in particular of how you guys break a story, how you divide up the writing responsibilities, what it was like writing the first episode that you actually wrote the script for, and just kind of a general overview of how it works.
Yeah. So every show is different. Every writer's room works differently. But in our room, the stories kind of live within our showrunner's life. You know, he tells a lot of like personal stories, but I think everyone in our room does. We all kind of share personal stories and then kind of mine those stories for our characters. We kind of go in knowing, or we go in and our boss knows, you know, I want this person to end up here by the end of the season. And to do that, we need to, like, what do we need to do? Where should we put them in every episode to sort of eventually get to that goal? So we'll kind of put up 10 goals, turning points, things that we know we'll sort of go ahead and put up on the board. And then really it's a lot of just talking and talking about, you know, experiences we've had and stories from our lives. And then once there's an episode idea, we run it by our boss, who then gives feedback. Either he likes it or he doesn't, or he loves this part but thinks we need to work on this. And here's an idea. How about, you know, whatever? And he usually has a fix pretty quick. But it's a lot of like collaborative conversation about story ideas. Like we do that part all together. And then he assigns the script to usually two writers, because we have, I think, 12 writers in the room. And those two writers will go off on outline, but we as a room go through all the story beats ahead of time. So like we all come up with like the story of the episode and then sort of fine break it into beats and really flesh out those scenes. And then the two writers go off and outline it. And then it comes back to the writers and we give notes and feedback, whatever. And then it goes to the studio and network. Then when it goes to script, those two writers like go off on script. The writers read like the first pass, or actually the showrunner reads the first pass and then decides whether or not it's ready to go to the writers. And there's a rewrite process. And then we go to a table read draft. By that point, the studio and network have signed off on the script. So we go to table read draft. We hear the actors do the script. And then after that, we all give our notes to the writers. And then there's like a plan, like either it needs a lot of work or only act three needs work, or, you know, it's good, or, you know, it's usually after the table read, there's at least one rewrite just to sort of punch up jokes that didn't work or, you know, solve any kind of story problems that might exist. And yeah, that's kind of how it works. There's no, in our room, at least it's a very communal process. Other rooms I know, sometimes the showrunner will write the last pass of every script, or they'll write every script themselves, or writers will go off and write a script and it's just between them and the showrunner and the writers aren't involved anymore. It just really depends on your room.
That's super cool. So you are living the dream, this dream you had back in college, and now you're writing on a show. Does it ever feel like a job? Does it feel magical every time you go in? Is it this really just cool, like you're pinching yourself all the time? What emotions are you feeling right now?
Well, I mean, it is definitely a dream, pinching myself all the time. I'm constantly looking around my apartment like, how did I do this? But, you know, it is also a job. Like there are elements of it. It can be very frustrating when you feel very passionate about something and someone else feels equally passionate about the opposite of what you're feeling and
right, yeah.
You know, debating it. It can be frustrating when a joke you pitch doesn't get in or doesn't land or you know, doesn't come out well. Certainly nerve-wracking when you submit a scene or a script for everyone's approval, because you get very or at least I get very protective of my words. And something I constantly have to work on is sort of accepting constructive criticism, which has never been my strong suit.
Yeah.
And sort of, you know, sometimes the hours are long. Sometimes production hours are super long and you're just tired and you want to go home. Sometimes you have a cold and you just want to, like, you know, never get out of bed ever again. There are lots of, when I was an assistant, of course, like, it was amazing all the time, but if, you know, you're doing someone else's, you know, expense reports and you're having to figure out annoying airline details and figuring out why lunch is late and, you know, things like that, that can just sort of be, when I was a writer's PA, lunch was the worst part of my day because
yeah,
it was like always late. And you're like thinking there are thousands of restaurants in Burbank. And they all know about writer's rooms and how come they can't get a single order right. And really, there was really a time when my boyfriend at the time was like, I need you to stop talking about lunch. And I was like, so I think that there are like times that are amazing, incredible. Obviously hearing something you've read performed is incredible. Having actors, yeah, you know, say your words and compliment you on a joke or, you know, just anything that has to do with seeing your name on television is like very, very cool. So
yeah,
overall, I would say it definitely feels like a dream most of the time.
That's amazing. So, all right. So we wrap this up with the same five questions every time. So these are, you know, rapid fire. Answer with the first thing that pops into your mind. First okay. One is what do you write?
I write mostly like dark comedy.
Okay. What is your proudest accomplishment?
Oh man. I think my proudest accomplishment was becoming a writer on a TV show.
How do you define success?
I define success as something that's constantly changing based on your present situation. But something that you can be proud of accomplishing.
And I do wonder that too, because you're, in most people's minds, you're pretty established. But the thing is that no matter how established you are, there's always another level, right? Like there's always another thing that you're striving for. Like it's impossible to fully be content. And I'm not sure people should ever really be content. Do you find that? Or are you kind of like, oh, you know what? I'm fine here. I'm good. I have nowhere else I need to be.
Oh my goodness. No, I think it's such a moving moment. And I think,
yeah,
more importantly, just to correct you for one second, I am not established. this is my first writing job. I was so lucky that my show came back. I was lucky that my boss wanted me back. I was lucky that, you know, there are so many things where opportunity met luck there and hard sure. work as well. You know, I'm not going to pretend that I didn't, you know, earn this, but I also know that, you know, I easily could have not done something and not ended up here. And
yeah,
that's always something that I think about, but especially like there are levels to being a writer, but like I'm just starting. I'm in the entry level writing position, basically.
Right.
Not entry yeah. level, but like I have nowhere to go right now, but up or extremely down. So I'm really hoping yeah. to keep going up. But I do think that success is such a different, like I said, a moving target. I also think that like so many people move out here with high expectations, and if they're not met, or even if they change their minds, I've had a lot of friends move out here and decide, you know, actually, I really want to go back east and marry the love of my life and live near my family and, you know, get a job there. And
yeah,
people are afraid to leave or announce that because they are worried that it makes them look or feel like a failure. Huh. But I don't believe that that's true. I think that their goals just changed. And if you're happy doing what you're doing, then you've managed to do something a ton of people haven't, you know?
Yeah. Gosh, I love that. What writers do you most look up to and why?
I really like, well, this is a novel writer, but my favorite author is Kevin Wilson. And there have been a bunch of things that his stuff has been made into, but I think he has like this really incredibly unique ability to embody a bunch of different voices. There's a story I read that he wrote where the main character was like an old woman. And I truly had to keep checking the back of the book to be like, this is a 40 something year old man, right? Like, how is he writing this so eloquently and in a way that really makes me believe that he's an old woman? So I think that is someone, I think like Tina Fey is someone that I look up to a lot. I think Mike Schur is an incredible writer. I obviously look up to my boss a lot. I consider him like a mentor to me. Yeah. There are so many writers I look up to. Another one of my favorite authors is Celeste Ng, and she is the author of the book That Little Fires Everywhere.
All right.
The show is based on, and I think she was heavily involved in that as well. So I have a lot of respect for people like that who can sort of really be different characters, especially with ensemble shows. I think that's really difficult to sort of differentiate character. I'm thinking like Aaron Sorkin. There are a bunch of people, a lot of people.
Finally, what advice would you give to your younger self?
I would say probably ignore the people that are making you feel terrible, because you're going to end up being really cool to them for whatever reason. And and also like, don't think so hard about succeeding, because unfortunately your 10-year high school reunion is probably going to be canceled due to a global pandemic. So you don't safe. And also,
that's funny.
Don't break into your sister's computer to use AIM, because you'll get grounded for the whole summer and you won't be allowed to go to camp.
That's great. My 20-year high school reunion got canceled just because the guy in charge didn't feel like doing it. So
he didn't even have
an excuse. All right, cool. So where can people follow you and keep up with what you're doing and all that?
People can follow me on Twitter. My handle is @SpeakingSarcasm. That's pretty much it. I'm on Instagram, but it's such a private, because too many people I didn't know were watching me eat meals and I wasn't comfortable with that. So pretty much just Twitter. Also, if you want to catch up on A Million Little Things, season 2 is fully on Hulu. I think season 1 is available for purchase somewhere. But there's also a DVD box set that, if you're a real fan, has a lot of commentary on it.
Ooh.
And that is, I think, pretty much it.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much. This was amazing. I love catching up with you over the past, 6 years or whatever, over this conversation. So this was very cool. I look forward to hanging out with you at some point.
Thank you so much for
this
asking.
This pandemic lifts. So
I'm sorry we went over so long. I know that I talk a lot.
No, you're great. It's funny. When I started this podcast, like the first one was like 20 minutes, and they're just, every episode's getting longer and longer and longer. But I kind of enjoy it, and I kind of think it's fun as long as people still want to listen, you know. And this was a fantastic one. I felt like everything you say was so important and will really help people on their own journeys to just realize what it takes to get to something resembling an endpoint, you know.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks again to Michelle for her time and her honesty about her journey. It's amazing how little decisions we make in life can open the door to crazy experiences and friendships. It makes me think, maybe there's magic to writing in coffee shops after all. Now it's your turn. If you're enjoying the podcast and you're ready to take that next step in your own screenwriting journey, be sure to check out scriptblast.com and our online community for conversations with like-minded screenwriters. Join today, free for a week, at members.scriptblast.com. Also, if you'd like to reach out to Hudson personally, you can reach him at hudson@scriptblast.com. See you next time.